Thank you for downloading from Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Support for this podcast comes from your generous gifts and donations. You can find out more about Ravi Zacharias and the team at www.rzim.org.
The Old Testament contains things that would push the R rating level in films to the upper limit, both on the sexual front and the violence front, and sometimes together.
Answers to some questions about Christianity come easily. Others, however, are more difficult. The issue of violence in the Old Testament falls under the latter category. Hello and welcome to Let My People Think, where this week, Dr. John Dixon is filling in for Ravi Zacharias. Dr. Dixon is the founding director of the Center for Public Christianity in Australia. And with a degree in theology and a doctorate in history, he is uniquely qualified to answer one of the most troubling questions about the Bible, that of violence in the Old Testament. Here's John Dixon with this week's message.
The first thing I want to say of six is simply this. Friends, concede the problem. Concede the problem. There are some extremely difficult things in the Old Testament. I wince when I read some Old Testament stories to my young boy. Now, that may partly have to do with my sort of protective, middle-class, comfortable culture. But I think even still there are some, frankly, horrible things in the Old Testament. The Old Testament contains things that would push the R rating level in films to the utter limit, both on the sexual front and the violence front, and sometimes together. And personally, I am relieved the new atheists haven't come across the worst of it. I'm glad they don't know their Bibles very well at all. What about Psalm 137? O daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is he who repays you for what you have done, he who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. Now, we might be able to say that God doesn't approve of the action, that this psalm is there to allow, give permission to the oppressed to feel this kind of revenge but not act on it. We could say that. But I'm with Gordon Fee, who says this passage is one of those, quote, turn the page real quick moments in the Bible. Friends, we must concede that there is a problem here. There are some difficult issues. And conceding this is both apologetically helpful. I mean, it's amazing how a frank admission can take the heat out of an argument. But more importantly, it's real. It's real. Now, God is big enough to cope with your admission to a skeptic that you don't get everything you read in the Bible. But some of it just baffles you. I'm going to return to this idea because it's important. Secondly, you can't separate the stories from their explanation. I think this is something you can say quite firmly to our skeptical friends. We need to point out that you can't pick a horrible story from the Old Testament without also accepting its narrative explanation. That's not fair. Now, this won't completely eliminate the problems, okay? Let me make that clear. But it does set the problems within a framework that makes them a little more understandable. Take the issue of the conquest of the land. Here's Richard Dawkins. He says, the ethnic cleansing begun in the time of Moses is brought to bloody fruition in the book of Joshua, a text remarkable for the bloodthirsty massacres it records and the xenophobic relish with which it does so. But a careful reading of the Old Testament provides a very different perspective. The narrative in the book of Joshua makes crystal clear that ethnicity has nothing to do with the conquest. In fact, in an ancient context, Joshua chapter 5 amounts to a deliberate repudiation of the normal understanding of a tribal conflict. In antiquity, this is what the meaning of this story in Joshua 5 is. You know the story. They're about to go and invade the land. This is the moment where they're about to be victorious, where the promise is to be fulfilled, and the angel of the Lord, the commander of the Lord's armies, something, this is a revelation of Jesus, a Christophany, we don't know, but the question is put to the commander of the Lord's armies, are you for us or for our enemies? What's the reply? Neither. And this is deliberately placed at the front of the book of Joshua to dismiss any notion that this has anything to do with God playing favorites, to do with ethnicity. The correct interpretation of the conquest is enshrined in Israel's law. Deuteronomy chapter 9 makes clear, after the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. No, it is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. It is not because of your righteousness or your integrity that you are going to take possession of their land, but on account of the wickedness of these nations. The Lord your God will drive them out before you to accomplish what he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Understand then, third time, that it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving this good land to possess, for you are a stiff-necked people. This is extraordinary in an ancient context. If you read ancient literature, this is not the sort of thing you get. This is actually a critique of the notion of ethnic cleansing, of the notion of tribal warfare. The explanation here has nothing to do with genocide, nothing to do with racially motivated destruction. It is to do with the judgment of God on the Canaanites. And remember, God ultimately judges Israel as harshly as the Canaanites. There is no favorites with God. The ethnic cleansing criticism just can't stick. The other thing that's worth noting about the narrative context of the conquest is that in Scripture, this is a particular moment in history. It was a particular action in a particular time for a particular situation. It is not repeated. In fact, unlike other conquesting nations from antiquity, there's no evidence that Israel ever tried to extend their borders beyond that promised land. It's not like they then went down and tried to take over Egypt and so on. It isn't a conquesting people. They understood themselves to be the divine instrument of exacting judgment on a profoundly wicked people. That is the narrative context. If you're going to take a story, as Dawkins does, you have to take its narrative explanation. Thirdly, and very importantly, just because a story appears in the Old Testament doesn't mean that it is approved of. Often the opposite is the case. If Dawkins and co. had bothered to read a single commentary on Genesis or Judges, from which they draw their best information, they would have discovered that one of the dominant themes of Genesis and Judges is precisely the wickedness of Israel and the kindness of God nonetheless. It is an oddity in antiquity that the biblical heroes are mostly anti-heroes. The logic of the Bible isn't look at Moses, look at David, look at Israel itself and copy them. No. It's look at how God is still gracious to these wicked sinners. For example, there is no way the narrator of Genesis 19 wants you to extract a moral example from the story of Lot handing out his two daughters in exchange for the, you know, for the host, for his guest rather. He's acting wickedly, and the town is not saved on account of Lot's righteousness, and Lot isn't saved on account of his righteousness. We see in the scriptures, Genesis 19:29, that it's on account of Abraham that God saved Lot and his family. But what about Abraham himself? Dawkins says this is a morally suspect act. Abraham willing to sacrifice his own son. Well, look, at one level, this is morally suspect. Okay, you should be arrested today if you try this one. But go back into the narrative. The point of the story in an ancient Jewish context, in an ancient Mediterranean context, is precisely that God forbids child sacrifice, for he will always provide the sacrifice. That's what the story means. And although we could quibble over the psychological damage this did to poor little Isaac, I bet you if Abraham and Isaac were here, they would be praising God that through this dramatic moment, this teaching was branded into the mind of Israel. God does not require child sacrifice, as many of the nations around them did, certainly the Canaanites. This is a deliberate setup story to say this is not how things work in the divine economy. Then there's the Jephthah incident in Judges 11, which Dawkins makes much of again. You know the story. Jephthah basically says to God, you know, if I beat these enemies, then I'll offer you as a burnt sacrifice the first thing that I see when I come back. And it happens to be his daughter. So he goes ahead with it. And of course, Dawkins makes much of this. Yeah, there's the morality of, you know, the biblical paradigm. Jephthah's action is clearly not approved of in the book of Judges. He is actually an example of someone who made a rash vow. In the Hebrew scriptures, in the Old Testament, the Torah names a thing called a rash vow that can be overturned. This is one such rash vow. And had the Torah been operating correctly in Israel in the period of the Judges, it ought to have been overturned, but it wasn't, and that's the point. Israel is descending into this bizarre kind of religion. The same can be said of the most gruesome of all stories in the Judges. I hardly need to describe it, but if you want a pretty nice description, either read the original or go to The God Delusion, where Dawkins waxes lyrical. What Dawkins doesn't mention is that the whole point of Judges, particularly this climactic, terrible incident of the concubine who's handed over, raped to death, and then she's chopped up into 12 pieces and sent to the tribes of Israel, is that Judges is making the point that Israel is wicked. And it's a point that comes in this recurring and climactic phrase in the whole book of Judges. How does the book of Judges end? There it is, 21:25. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. That's the point of the book of Judges. My Old Testament teacher, Barry Webb, from Moore College, who got his doctorate at Sheffield in the book of Judges, makes a wonderful case, and I commend his work to you. Barry Webb, I can't remember the title, but it's the book of Judges and it's Sheffield Academic Press, makes the point that Judges is all about the unravelling of Israel's institutions to the point of absolute degradation. My main point here is that the new atheists do us a deep discourtesy by not bothering to read the Old Testament carefully. If I went out to criticize a scientific theory, I guarantee I would not just try and pick some unrepresentative data without also trying to understand the background theories and the models that scientists use to understand the data. You don't find that kind of approach toward the Old Testament in the new atheists. Fourthly, and I'll just make this point very quickly, Israelite laws about warfare, social ethics, and punishments are infinitely more just and compassionate than those of their ancient Near Eastern neighbours. And any ancient Near Eastern historian will agree with that. Old Testament scholar Alden Thompson speaks of God incrementally humanising the ancient Near East through Israel. For time's sake, and partly because I don't think this is a very powerful argument, I'll do nothing more than just point your attention to an important article by Paul Copan, Is Yahweh a Moral Monster? In Philosophia Christi. There's the volume 10, number 1 from 2008. The fifth thing I want to say about the problem of Old Testament violence is this, and it relates to something I said in connection with homosexuality. the violence of the Old Testament must be read through the lens of the New Testament. The point here is that some rays of Old Testament light are refracted through the Christ event into the New Testament with little change. The sexual ethics of the Old Testament are an example. Some rays of Old Testament light are in fact intensified as they come into the new covenant, such as love your neighbor becoming love your enemy. And some things in the Old Testament are refracted beyond recognition as they enter into the new era. And among these concepts are holy war, theocracy, and temporal judgment within time. I'm not saying God doesn't judge ever in time now, but where is that the default position in the Old Covenant? The judgment has been suspended to the day of the Lord in the New. Christians can never validly say that a conquest or violence of the Old Testament provides justification for so acting in the New Covenant. This flies in the face of the new atheist default position, which is, it's in the Old Testament, therefore Christians believe that that's how you should act, which is basically how their argument works. That does not pay us the courtesy of reading the scriptures the way we have always read. This is not smoke and mirrors designed to help us pick and choose which bits we like. This is how the church has always read the Old Testament. Apart from some fringe groups, historic Christianity has never read the Old Testament as a direct revelation to the people of God in the New Covenant. The sixth and perhaps most important thing that I say on this issue of the Old Testament violence is that a robust theory may still hold together despite inconsistencies. We need to acknowledge that there are some Old Testament ethics and actions that look inconsistent with the one revealed to us in Jesus. I don't for a second think I've resolved many of the issues. But here's the thing. When you come across a discrepancy, an inconsistency, in a robust theory, whether historical or scientific, it doesn't bring the whole thing down. You can live in the tension. I'll give you just some examples. Here's a historical example. The great majority of experts on Roman Palestine believe that the Dead Sea Scrolls were written by a group of Jews known as the Essenes. Okay? That is the dominant view of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But there are some facts that are inconsistent with that. Some of the things that Josephus says that Essenes believed are actually contradicted in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So a few scholars, and they're a tiny minority actually, have proposed that we give up the theory that the Essenes produced the Dead Sea Scrolls. But most scholars aren't budging because too many other lines of evidence point in the direction that the Essenes produced the Dead Sea Scrolls. What they do is they try and imagine ways in which the inconsistencies might fit into the larger theory. The larger theory holds together. It doesn't collapse, even though there are still to this day some inconsistencies in the evidence. What about a scientific example? Our atheist friends regularly like to tell us that the theory of evolution is established fact. But they also know full well that there are some inconsistencies in the theory of evolution as it now stands. The fossil record doesn't suggest the small incremental changes we expect. And the Cambrian explosion offers a special problem. Now, I know that there are scientists working on ways of resolving these inconsistencies, but as yet there isn't agreement on what explains this data. Okay? Nevertheless, committed evolutionists still ask us to accept the theory despite the inconsistencies because, they tell us, other multiple lines of evidence point in the direction of the theory. And I think this is an important one to raise with your atheist friends because they so firmly accept evolution with inconsistencies that aren't resolved. And what I'm saying is that we can admit that parts of the Old Testament really do trouble us deeply and that we can't see how they fit into the wider theory. Not that Jesus is a theory. We can also try and imagine ways in which the data might fit, actually. I've got some wild speculations that I'm not willing to say in public. But there are enough indications on other grounds, philosophical, historical, personal, that the God of the Old Testament is the God of love revealed in Jesus. We can cling to that as a robust paradigm, despite the fact that I'm still troubled by things I read in the Old Testament. Well, let me conclude part A. At CPX, we recently had the privilege of interviewing Professor Michael Ruse from Florida University. And he's a well-known atheist, and yet he's a well-known critic of the new atheists. And one of the delightful things he said in the interview, and you can see the footage at publicchristianity.org, is that he hates the way Dawkins thinks he has found questions Christians haven't thought about. And he actually says at one point, quote, "Christians have some very grown-up answers to this stuff, but Dawkins and co. don't bother to read them." Let me move on to point B. Violence of the church through history. How is it that the followers of Jesus ever came to be associated with violence, power, and imperialism? The slogan, "Religion leads to violence," finds plausibility today, in my view, not through facts and logic, but through simple repetition. And I am amazed at how often the criticism comes up. Just a couple of weeks ago, I'm at lunch with a whole bunch of skeptical people, and one of them pipes up and says, "Religion, particularly Christianity, started all the wars." And I said, "Which ones?" He thought a moment and he said, "The Crusades, Northern Ireland, hardly all the wars." Perhaps he'd been reading Christopher Hitchens' "God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything," who says, "We believe with certainty that an ethical life can be lived without religion. And we know for a fact that the corollary holds true, that religion has caused innumerable people not just to conduct themselves no better than others, but to award themselves permission to behave in ways that would make a brothel keeper or an ethnic cleanser to raise an eyebrow. In Belfast, I have seen whole streets burned out by sectarian warfare between different sects of Christianity, and interviewed people whose relatives and friends have been kidnapped and killed or tortured by rival religious death squads, often for no other reason than membership of another confession." And my lunchtime friend would have found great comfort in a three-part series that showed on Australian television recently. Have you seen this one? The Secrets of the Inquisition? Beautifully shot. Terrible. Here the church is presented as doing nothing but torturing, raping, pillaging, mass murdering through the 350-year Spanish Inquisition. And as I was preparing this material, the major Australian newspaper, the Sunday Age, offered this stunning piece of secularist apologetics. "The question I can't escape," says Michael Coulter, who's one of the editors of the newspaper, "is why so many people clearly prefer the realm of faith, the realm of Inquisition and violent jihad, to the realm of thought." In my view, thought actually isn't the secularist's best friend on this particular issue. The "religion leads to violence" mantra has become a truism in our culture, mainly because fascinating people, popular books, and high production documentaries have said it so often, it's true now. But it isn't true. not in the blanket sense that's often intended. What can we say? I think there are a few things we can go on the front foot with. But first, we need to go on the back foot and concede a partial truth. I doubt you will find any Christian today who is not rightly and deeply ashamed of the Inquisition, the Crusades, and so on. We concede that these are terrible departures from the faith. We confess it.
You've been listening to guest speaker Dr. John Dixon in a message titled Violence in the Old Testament. If you'd like to purchase a complete copy of Dr. Dixon's talk, simply call us at 1-800-448-6766 and ask for the program by name. That number once again is 1-800-448-6766. Or you can order online or listen to this broadcast again at rzim.org. And while you're there, we invite you to take a look at our three digital publications, all of which can be delivered right to your inbox. Find out more at rzim.org. To contact us by mail or to make a donation, write to RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. Join us again next week as we hear more from our guest, Dr. John Dixon. Let My People Think is a listener-supported radio ministry and is furnished by Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.